Welcome to this special audio spinoff program of a CME satellite meeting held at the annual GI Cancer Symposium in San Francisco in January. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The distinguished faculty members for the meeting were Drs. Dirk Arnold, Johanna Bendel, Tony Bakai-Saab, Axel Grothy, Howard Hoxter, and Philip Philip. The format for the meeting was that we conducted video interviews with several general oncologists in community-based practice prior to the meeting and picked the most interesting cases to present to the faculty for their feedback and also for audience feedback in a series of management questions we posed by the use of iPads. After the meeting, I met first with Dr. Philip and then Dr. Bakai-Saab to go back through the cases for this audio program, focusing on gastroesophageal, pancreatic, and colorectal cancer. But to begin, I asked Dr. Philip about another unusual situation, a 49-year-old woman with widespread intra-abdominal appendiceal cancer.
When I see someone with, especially a young patient who's young and fit, when I see someone like that and they have appendiceal carcinoma, metastatic appendiceal carcinoma, the pathology is really important because what you want to see is, does this patient have the more indolent type of, when I say indolent, obviously it's a relative term, indolent type of pseudomyxoma type disease, or do they have more active adenocarcinoma? Because my approach to the patient will be somewhat different. So patients who have more of the pseudomyxoma type or the abdomen full of the gelatin type stuff, those patients will not respond to chemotherapy, because they really do not have much in the way of dividing cells. And also these patients, I see people doing PET scans on them, and the PET scan isn't going to pick up much in those patients. Those patients, I will get an opinion from a surgeon who does debulking surgery, peritonectomy, and also the HIPEC. And I wouldn't send them to anybody. I would send them to somebody who really is an expert in these, because surgery is something which is very important to be done properly, but also the postoperative care can be very tricky. Those patients can be in hospital for a long time with ileus and other things. In patients who have more like the active type of adenocarcinoma, those patients, I would start them on chemotherapy. And the reason I say that is because I have worked with at least one surgeon who is close to where I work, and they like us to start with some chemotherapy maybe for 3 months, maybe 6 months maximum, and then they would like to go in and do the debulking in the HIPEC. In those patients, they wouldn't like maybe to go right away and do it. In terms of the drugs we use, as you know, there has not been a study which is looking at appendiceal cancer on its own, so we don't have drugs outside of the drugs we use for colon cancer. So FOLFOX will be the drug to use, a combination or CAPOX or whatever you want to do as a frontline treatment. But certainly there's no one drug which has been shown to be more active in this disease. And again, based on what we see in terms of the molecular profiling, there hasn't been anything which is really standing out as something which is going to be specific and for us to test some specific drugs for this disease. But certainly when I see someone who's young and healthy and has mucinous disease in the abdomen from an appendix, I would like to see how I can time my debulking and the HIPEC if the disease was stage 4, as you had explained.
And yeah, this doc was particularly curious about the debulking / HIPEC. Have you seen patients that, you know, you thought clearly benefited from that kind of strategy? When I hear about it, all I think about is problems.
Again, you hear about the problems because of choice of the patient, patients who have more active disease, which is not really going to be stopped by just doing debulking, patients who might be not the right age or the overall performance status, patients who may have been sent after years of, or when I say years, maybe a year or two of chemotherapy, which has really changed things to the point that the complications would be more. When you see someone like this, you have to really get the opinion of the surgeon as soon as you can, because that's when you're going to put a joint decision or a plan for the patient to try to avoid unnecessary chemotherapy and try to also avoid doing the procedure in certain patients. There is now a scoring system with the surgeons use in terms of which patients may benefit more or not. So you really have to have a surgeon help you when the initial diagnosis is made to help to do that. Now, have I seen patients who benefit? Yes, I've certainly seen patients who have benefited, and those were the patients who we were able to select them properly. Now, it could be that their benefit could have happened even if they didn't have the debulking, because they were not part of a randomized trial, and we don't have strong randomized data in this situation. But certainly, the benefit I've seen in some patients was striking enough to make me think that if it's not a cure, it's something which will delay their progression, and sometimes it will delay the progression and the worsening by many years. So you have to remember here that when you do debulking, you're also in some ways trying to remove the tumor that also can cause multiple problems, and the most important one obviously is the bowel obstruction. Having repeated bowel obstructions and fistula formation sometimes, these are not a good way to die. And if we can even try to relieve those complications in a patient for the longest possible time, then you're giving them a quality of life. Remember, your chemotherapy is never going to be able to debulk those tumors. Oftentimes they are, as I mentioned, mucinous, gelatinous. Chemotherapy does not work, does not get to the tumor cells that well. And there are not that many tumor cells if you look at these sections. That's why they don't take the PET marker. So if you choose your patients well, I think you will end up with patients who we will see they get benefit in the long run. Not a cure, but delaying the progression of the disease.
So let's move on and talk about gastroesophageal cancer. And one of the cases we heard about was a 72-year-old man who had locally advanced near-obstructing HER2-negative adenocarcinoma of the GE junction. The patient was initially treated with carbapaclitaxel and radiation therapy, but a few months later developed metastatic disease. So we presented this case to the audience via iPad, remembering now that the patient had the recent carbapaclitaxel radiation therapy, and they were pretty well split between using FOLFOX and the other major choice was ramucirumab paclitaxel. Any thoughts?
So basically, one of the key things in deciding on this patient would be performance status, organ function, but also neuropathy. But my assumption is that this patient only received chemotherapy for the 6 cycles during the radiotherapy.
Right.
So it's unlikely that the patient developed neuropathy. By the same token, it's unlikely this patient had enough systemic exposure to the taxane and also the carboplatin or the platinum compound. So in this patient, going with a weekly taxane plus ramucirumab will be one of the options which I would provide the patient with. The other would be a FOLFOX. It's also a possible option, but I personally probably would go with more like a ramucirumab plus a taxane in a patient like this in the second line setting, just trying to change the treatment a bit more than just giving FOLFOX. But FOLFOX certainly is a valid option in this patient, and you can always go back to it.
Another question we ask the audience is whether or not they would consider using ramucirumab with another chemotherapeutic agent other than paclitaxel, and more than a quarter of the audience would, and another, about a sixth of the audience, would only use it, but would use it with another taxane, presumably docetaxel. What are your thoughts about the possibility of using another chemotherapeutic agent other than paclitaxel with ramucirumab?
So strictly regarding the question that you're asking me about combining ramucirumab with another cytotoxic agent, for example, irinotecan would be something comes to my mind right away. So there is no evidence based on a prospective trial to use the combination. However, since ramucirumab has activity on its own, I think combining it with irinotecan could be a consideration. And here, you have to really sit and think about what are the side effects that might be additive that you might have to think about or to anticipate when you give such a combination. Ramucirumab side effects will not overlap with the side effects of irinotecan, at least the ones we know of. Is there a possibility that they may make the side effects to irinotecan more noticeable, another possibility, but I have used the combination myself, so with my limited experience with the number of patients I've treated, it's a well-tolerated combination. However, it's not based on a randomized trial of like ramucirumab plus irinotecan versus irinotecan alone, but I do not really have an objection to using the combination, again, given the couple of facts. One, ramucirumab is active on its own, so you'd expect an additive effect, and number two, the side effects are not overlapping, and therefore you're not going to either get unusual or augment the side effects or have to reduce the doses of the two drugs. So I think that combination is a reasonable one. Ramucirumab has also been combined, for example, with FOLFOX, and there is experience with that, and that's also a tolerable combination. So I do not have a real objection for combining ramucirumab with another cytotoxic agent apart from the paclitaxel that has been combined with in the clinical trial.
Another answer that was given by 12% of the audience in that situation was ramucirumab alone. Is that a strategy that you've used? I've heard people talk about that in, older patients, for example.
I have used it maybe in two or three patients where basically they could not get the cytotoxic drug for reasons of performance status, organ dysfunction, or also because of the fact they had neuropathy, and therefore combining it with another agent that will cause neuropathy is not an option. Again, there is evidence, clear evidence, that ramucirumab on its own has activity when tested against best supportive care, so it is an option. But in someone who can get cytotoxic drug and is due to get a cytotoxic change because they haven't received that cytotoxic drug, then combining it with ramucirumab is my first option. It wouldn't be a single agent ramucirumab.
What has been your clinical experience with ramucirumab?
So my experience with ramucirumab started when we were also part of a clinical trial where we were studying it in patients with gastric cancer, advanced gastric cancer. And we treated a fair number of patients in combination with chemotherapy. And knowing about the mechanism of action of the drug and having had experience with the previous class of agents like bevacizumab, which also targeted VEGF-VEGFR, it was a bit surprising that it appeared to me that ramucirumab was very well tolerated despite the fact that it extended its activity beyond VEGF-A, which was a target for bevacizumab, because ramucirumab targets the VEGFR2, which also receives growth factors more than the VEGF-A. But despite that, despite its more broader activity in terms of the biological activity, or think what we think about it, it did not really have much in the way of the side effects we expect with this class of agents. So treating a number of patients, we did not really had to stop the treatment because of hypertension or the proteinuria that we saw with the monoclonal antibodies that were targeting the VEGF-A, VEGF-R receptor axis. And we did also not notice any increase in the side effects of chemotherapy that sometimes can occur with this class of agents. So the use of the chemotherapy combined with the ramucirumab, patients did not tolerate the treatment worse than what they would expect if they received the treatment, the chemotherapy on its own. So a drug that had a very good therapeutic index, a good toxicity profile, and appeared to be a drug that can be easily combined with other chemotherapy agents.
You have any sense in terms of efficacy? It's kind of difficult because the patients, at least when you use the chemotherapy, they're getting the chemotherapy. But do you have any sense about whether or not it improves efficacy, or are you just kind of more going on faith from the clinical trials?
Again, our experience with a few of the patients we treated, we had several patients who stayed on the treatment for a very long time. And those patients had a remission state which was prolonged. Now, again, based on few patients, I cannot give you a definite answer about its efficacy, but it appeared that the patients who would have received chemotherapy alone, in our experience, would have stayed on the treatment for a shorter period of time. So there was a certain prolongation of the progression-free survival in those patients.
How would you approach that? I don't know whether this has actually happened in your practice. If a patient develops problems from the paclitaxel, for example, neuropathy, would you then stop that and keep the ramucirumab going?
If a patient is doing combination of paclitaxel and ramucirumab, which is the common combination we use, if we have to stop the paclitaxel, and usually this is because of a neuropathy, as you indicated, then we would continue on the ramucirumab if the patient is not progressing otherwise, because if they have also disease progression, then that's a different story. But if they're only having a side effect related to the paclitaxel, then it is our way of dealing with patients is to continue with the ramucirumab as a single agent. Again, just to remind you that there was evidence of single agent activity in this situation based on the randomized trial with the ramucirumab versus no treatment except for best supportive care.
You mentioned two trials, the REGARD study looking at ramucirumab alone, and then ramucirumab with paclitaxel on the so-called RAINBOW study. Can you talk a little bit about what those two trials demonstrated and what you think the results mean in terms of clinical practice?
Well, the first trial, that was the ramucirumab versus best supportive care. In that trial, there was a prolongation of the progression-free survival and also overall survival. Basically, it really gave us a good indication of the activity of the drug as a single agent, which is oftentimes important, but oftentimes also overlooked because people think of these drugs that they only enhance the effect of the chemotherapy, whereas a single agent activity of a target agent, especially within the class of monoclonal antibodies that target the VEGF-VEGFR, a single agent, we hadn't seen much of it in patients with GI cancer. So that was a nice demonstration of single agent activity. It also indicated that this drug might be more than just a VEGF inhibitor type or blocker that we were used to see, for example, with bevacizumab and aflibercept. And this drug has a broader biological activity, but certainly with that study, we cannot make this statement as a definite statement. And then the following trial was the combination of the ramucirumab with paclitaxel given as a weekly treatment. And the weekly paclitaxel is a second-line treatment, so it was a real-life situation where patients who have progressed on a fluoropyrimidine, a platinum-based regimen, went on second-line treatment, and then the combination of the two drugs versus ramucirumab alone. Again, this randomized trial showed the improvement in the efficacy parameters. These were objective response rate, progression-free survival, and also survival. So a good study to demonstrate a combination of two drugs showing a clinically beneficial and important improvement in survival of patients with metastatic or advanced gastric and GE junction cancers.
Are there studies right now looking at it the first-line setting? Are there any situations where you'd consider it right now in the first-line setting?
I have not used it in the first-line setting, but yes, there is now an interest, and in fact, there are studies looking at the first-line setting, but that's something which we don't have any evidence to go by at this time. Although there was a study that was done, which was, in fact, in terms of overall survival, maybe not significant, but it also gave us an idea of what we'd expect in the frontline setting. In fact, in that study, looking back at the analyses, there was an indication of activity in the frontline setting, but we don't have a randomized phase 3 trial, a standard setting trial at this time. The chemo backbone was FOLFOX, which is, at this point in time, people mostly use as a frontline setting. It was a combination with FOLFOX, but there was evidence of activity, although it did not reach the point of showing a survival difference. But then again, it was a pilot trial. But we would like to wait to see a more robust study to test that hypothesis that adding ramucirumab in the frontline setting is beneficial. Again, I have to say there was evidence of activity in that setting.
You mentioned the hypertension that can occur with ramucirumab. Do you approach that pretty much the same way as with bevacizumab? And I'm curious what your usual initial antihypertensive strategy is in a patient who never had hypertension.
Yes, I approach it exactly the same, because if you look at the mechanism of action, probably it's the same, hitting the VEGFR pathway. And in my practice, I start patients on lisinopril, which is my drug of choice starting point, and then I manage the hypertension, depending on how they respond to the lisinopril. I've started patients on other medications like Norvasc, but usually an ACE inhibitor is my first choice of treatment, unless there is a contraindication to it. And oftentimes, the blood pressure is well controlled if the patient always compliant with the medication.
So another question that this clinician had about this patient, knowing that the patient kind of was destined to have disease progression at some point, is what new and encouraging strategies are out there that might be a consideration in the future. And one that we asked you to chat about at the meeting was an interesting strategy of using a stem cell inhibitor. In this case, it was BBI-608, which in a trial reported at ASCO last year was combined with paclitaxel. Can you comment a little bit about what these agents do and what we know about them clinically?
Well, these are drugs that, as the name implies, they're targeting the stem cell population. And we all know that drug resistance in treating patients is probably related to the persistence of clones of cells that are not dividing very fast, but they're sitting in the background trying to produce dividing cells when the opportunity comes. In this case, drug resistance, they become resistant to the treatment. And therefore, the combination with chemotherapy offers an opportunity to try to get rid of as many possible of these cells in order to prolong the time to progression and improve survival. This is a new class of agents, and at this point in time, we're still in the experimental phase, although in the pilot trials, there is evidence that we may be getting a new class of agents that may go into the clinic, but we're still very early days.
Now, are these TKIs?
Yes.
Any tolerability issues with these stem cell inhibitors?
So these stem cell inhibitors are more specific to the stem cells which are within the tumor cells, and therefore their chances of producing significant side effects is really not as much of a problem. And the side effects we get are the usual TKI side effects, for example, diarrhea, fatigue.
And another new strategy that there's been a lot of interest in a lot of different tumors, but also gastric cancer, we're starting to see a little data coming out too, is anti-PD-1 antibodies. What do we know about this in gastric cancer?
Well, this is, again, a new area, and there is an explosion of interest and also studies trying to look at the PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors. And there has been some early reports. For example, there was the drug from Merck, which was tested, and there was the early reporting last year, which showed that there was evidence of activity in the form of response rate, objective response rate, not only objective response, but prolongation of the progression-free interval. But that was a pilot trial. It was a small number of patients, but still the outcome was so interesting that there are now a number of randomized trials that are being started. Some of them have already started to test the activity of these class of agents in the front line, second line, and even beyond the second line.
So we also had a couple of cases of HER2-positive gastric cancer. One was a 76-year-old lady who really, it sounded like, had a real Lazarus syndrome experience, presented with profoundly poor performance status, actually came into the office in a wheelchair, widespread disseminated disease, had a great response to FOLFOX trastuzumab, and then continued on 5-FU trastuzumab maintenance. Actually, was on the therapy for 3.5 years. And by that time, at the age of 80, developed disease progression. And the question there was the approach to a patient in that situation, particularly the idea of the strategy that's been used a lot in breast cancer of keeping anti-HER2 therapy going and like switching the chemo or maybe bringing back in the Oxali. How do you approach second-line therapy, that decision of HER2-positive gastric cancer?
So in the second-line situation, you have at least 2 or 3 options. So in a patient who failed, in this case, FOLFOX trastuzumab, in the second-line setting, if they don't have much in the way of neuropathy or troubling neuropathy like grade 2 or above, those patients, I would switch them to weekly paclitaxel plus trastuzumab. Patients who cannot take the taxane because of reasons of neuropathy, then those patients, I have also treated them with irinotecan plus the trastuzumab. In the second-line setting, after failing 5-fluorouracil, I do not use FOLFIRI. I'd rather use single-agent irinotecan plus trastuzumab. I've done that. Now, some patients may not be candidates for any chemotherapy, and again, those patients, you may try to use the trastuzumab alone, but the patient has already progressed, so that does not make sense. So in that case, you can consider changing the patient to a treatment such as ramucirumab single agent. It's another option in those patients.
Right, and this physician actually specifically was asking about the issue of ramucirumab in HER2-positive disease. So, for example, have you ever done or considered ramucirumab plus trastuzumab or ramucirumab plus paclitaxel plus trastuzumab?
Using a triple drug combination, ramucirumab, trastuzumab, and paclitaxel, no, I haven't done that. And again, I always like to maybe use my drugs progressively rather than put them all together. So, no, I haven't done that. And again, the question becomes the issue of toxicity. Now, ramucirumab plus trastuzumab, as I mentioned earlier, the side effects, you look at the side effects, when you have a combination that has not been tested before, then looking at the side effects and trying to see if is there going to be any additive effect. Given what we know about the two drugs, and we know very well about trastuzumab, it does not cause hypertension. We know that the other side effects that may arise from ramucirumab, they're not shared by trastuzumab and vice versa. So theoretically, you can combine the two drugs. But again, that's based on no prospective evidence. And I also doubt if there's any retrospective evidence for a reason, because the group of patients who we treat with trastuzumab, they're not that many, they're very few. So I don't think there's enough time for people to have developed an experience, a clinical experience with the combination and be able to write it up even as a retrospective analysis. But theoretically, I don't see a strong objection to use the combination together.
Yeah, and I guess that the actual ramucirumab trials, I don't think either they didn't measure HER2 or wasn't an exclusion. I think that was kind of in the pre-anti-HER2 days. So I think there were HER2-positive patients in that study. It's just they weren't identified. Is that your understanding?
Yes, and they weren't identified, and they didn't really record the experience subsequently if they used trastuzumab plus, but I wouldn't think they really had any patients who had trastuzumab plus ramucirumab in those studies.
So another obvious question that all docs have, again, based on how much is going on with breast cancer, is some of the newer agents that are being used in breast cancer, specifically pertuzumab and TDM1. What do we know about those agents, and would you ever consider using that in HER2-positive gastric cancer?
I haven't used them myself, and as you well know, there are currently studies looking into that. But at this point in time, I haven't really developed any personal experience with these agents outside of a clinical trial. So again, I think in a patient who is progressing and you're running out of options, I personally think that these are drugs which are worth considering. I will consider them in a patient, maybe if I'm out of any options. I work in a center where we also do clinical trials, so we always have an option for the patient. But I think outside of a clinical trial, it is an option. Again, if the cost of the treatment is also reimbursed or covered by the insurance or whoever's covering the patient's healthcare.
My understanding is that I guess we don't really have any definitive data on pertuzumab because since it's combined, you kind of have to wait for a combination trial or phase 3 study. But in terms of TDM1, since it is used as a single agent, do you know if any objective responses have been observed with TDM1 in HER2-positive gastric cancer?
There were some isolated reports, but not part of a phase 2 trial.
So as far as you know, you think that there have been isolated reports?
Yes.
Interesting. So I want to touch on pancreatic cancer, and in particular, one case was a patient with metastatic disease and a lot of anorexia and weight loss. And the question was raised about the potential future role of JAK inhibitors in patients like that. And we talked about the randomized phase 2 data on the combination of ruxolitinib and capecitabine and the efficacy that was observed in patients with elevated C-reactive protein. Any comments?
Well, first of all, the ruxolitinib is a drug that targets the JAK-STAT pathway, as you have mentioned. And this pathway is very much at the receiving end and the transmitting the signals of the cytokines. And cytokines play a role in probably all cancers, but in particular in pancreatic cancer, we know that the patients can have constitutional symptoms that sometimes go out of proportion to the amount of the disease that we see on films, on CA19, et cetera. So there is a group of patients who have what we call the inflammatory type of reaction of the body to the presence of the cancer. And this is also reflected by elevation in the cytokines in the system, in the blood, and also the C-reactive protein, which is an old marker or biomarker, if you would, for inflammatory conditions that we have used in medicine for a long time. By inhibiting the JAK-STAT pathway, we're trying to achieve at least two things. One is it's a growth factor pathway, so it also has a role in the proliferation of the cancer cells and also how they respond to chemotherapy. But also we're trying to target the inflammatory mediators that are responsible for much of what we see in terms of the fatigue, in terms of the cachexia. In fact, people have said the muscle wasting is probably also due to the effect of these cytokines, for example, the IL-6, just to give an example. So trying to use ruxolitinib to hit that pathway, we're not only trying to slow down the cancer cell from progressing, but also we're trying to make the patient feel better by controlling the effect of the cytokines. And by making the patient feel better, not only making them feel better, but also allowing them the opportunity to get the cytotoxic treatment in a better way, in a more sustained and consistent way. So all these things come together in terms of the hypothesis that using a drug like ruxolitinib will improve the outcome of patients who have advanced pancreatic cancer.
And of course, we're looking forward to seeing the results of a phase 3 study that's going to look at this in the patients with high C-reactive protein. But of course, the drug is approved now for myelofibrosis and polycythemia vera. And we asked the audience, if you could access ruxolitinib, let's say a patient was willing to pay for it, and the patient had disease progression on systemic therapy for metastatic pancreatic cancer, had a high C-reactive protein, had weight loss, would you consider it in combination with capecitabine? And interestingly, 2/3 of the audience said yes. What would you say?
I think to me that's a right answer in a disease where we don't have options. Now, why do I say that? If you don't have a clinical trial that you can fit your patient into in the second line setting, and if you have access to a drug like ruxolitinib in the subgroup of patients who are looking iller and maybe because of that reason they may not go on a clinical trial, and in a disease like this where we have a short window of opportunity and also very limited or no opportunities, then anything that can help the patient to be better will help. But the real question would be, if I have someone who also has an elevated CRP, So the two questions are, one, what is the cutoff point of the CRP I'm going to use? In the pilot trial that you referred to, the cutoff point was 13. That's the cutoff point when they looked back at their patient and saw the benefit in patients who have 13 and more of the CRP. However, in the current prospective trial in pancreatic cancer, they're using 10 as a cutoff point. So what's the cutoff point I'm going to use for me to think that the patient's going to benefit from it? So that's the biomarker I'm going to use. The second question is, what about using it not only with capecitabine, but using it with the second-line treatment that some patients get, for example, CAPOX or FOLFOX? I don't see a problem in even combining it with a CAPOX or a FOLFOX in that situation. If I can combine it with the capecitabine, I can also probably add the oxaliplatin if a patient is going to take the combination or is up to getting a combination, because that's the combination that we use in the second-line setting in patients whose performance status still allows them to get a second-line treatment, obviously patients who do not have significant neuropathy from the first-line treatment.
And have you actually done that?
I have not done that myself, because we have a lot of clinical trials going on in our place, so I haven't done it. But I would do it if I have access to the drug. Again, the limiting factor here to me is more having access to the drug.
So another agent that we talked about in pancreatic cancer is MM398. Can you explain what that is and what we know about it?
Well, MM398 is a drug that was developed based on some promising preclinical activity. In essence, the drug is a liposomal irinotecan. And for a while, obviously, we didn't think much of irinotecan, but now with the FOLFIRINOX regimen, we now consider irinotecan as one of the active drugs in pancreatic cancer, although we don't know how active it is as a single agent or even in combination, because in FOLFIRINOX, it was part of a three-drug regimen. The liposomal irinotecan study, the NAPOLI study, was a phase 3 trial in the second-line setting, and that study was presented last year, as you know, and the combination of the liposomal irinotecan or the MM398 plus 5-FU, similar to saying a FOLFIRI-type combination, was superior to single-agent chemotherapy. And that study showed improvement in the progression-free survival and overall survival of patients, again, in the second-line setting, patients who failed frontline treatment, in this situation, gemcitabine-based therapy. So an option for the second-line setting in patients, for example, who fail gemcitabine alone or gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel. I will not use it in patients who fail the FOLFIRINOX because I would assume they have been exposed to the irinotecan in the front line, and I would rather use something else.